they'll start off in a regular individual, let's say. They'll say we're auditing your charity deduction, your mortgage deduction, and then, you know, one little thing, they won't even say, you know, they'll say your depreciation deduction without even getting so technical into the real estate professional status. And once you come to the audit...
Welcome to the Real Estate Professional Status Podcast. Join me as I sit down with the tax experts and real estate investors to learn how you can qualify for the real estate professional status and how you can use it to amplify your real estate investments. My name is Usher Fried. Let's get right to it.
My name is Olav Jacobowitz. I worked for IRS for 10 years. Then I started my own practice, filing tax returns, helping plan, and fighting the IRS. I'm actually now joining another firm, which primarily with them I'll be preparing tax returns, but I'll still be having my own practice finding the IRS.
So welcome. Thank you for coming on to the show. Glad to have you here. So you basically are switching sides. You were on Team IRS, and now all of a sudden you're fighting the IRS.
Yes.
How did that happen? Did they switch up the teams? Did you get kicked out? We know the IRS eats their own people because we know that the IRS audits IRS staff members who claim reps, right? So we know that much.
And I never got audited, but plenty of coworkers get audited. Officially, they do, and they definitely do very heavy scrutiny on those audits. Very little wiggle room. They're after them. They're audited. They're not on the same team on the audits. That's for sure.
Uh-huh. It's not even an incentive to work for the IRS. Like, at least you won't get audited. You're saying the opposite is true.
This is actually a person that's going through matching the returns. It's not a computer. It's a real person. And they do that officially for all employees. Heavy scrutiny and the gray areas they disallow, penalties they throw on.
Oh, gosh. Sounds horrible. Sounds absolutely horrible. I mean, I guess it's like a motivation because that when they go to audit other people, they get audited so heavily, they want to make sure they do a good job and people shouldn't get away with it.
The union actually heavily recommended that if your wife has a business, you file married filing separate to avoid the heavy scrutiny and the unfair disallowance from the IRS to their employees.
Man, I'm happy you got out.
Yes.
I guess tell us more about what you did for the IRS when you worked for them.
I audited tax returns. That was...
Did you audit just regular tax returns, or did you also audit the real estate professional status specifically?
There was times that you were doing, you know, certain projects on one specific issue, but it was generally all types of returns. Personal, business, corporate.
Interesting. So,
partnership.
So it's not like one division is taking care of real estate professional status. It's really just your tax return is getting audited. Now, if you happen to have been filing for real estate professional status, that gets put under scrutiny as well.
Well, there's something called a DIF score, which is basically every return gets scored to chances of change happening and, you know, how much of a change that would be. Obviously, with a real estate professional, it's, you know, generally going to be a higher percentage of change. So automatically that would score higher.
Uh-huh. Okay. So could you tell us more about this? Because it's well known that real estate professional status is highly audited. There's a lot of court cases against it. So I guess let's start from the beginning. Why is it so highly audited and how does this whole system work?
I mean, it's just going to be general. Any types of deductions that are historically, when audited, provide a nice tax bill at the end are generally going to be heavily audited. That's just the reality. And, you know, it's not that they're specifically even going after it, but let's say charity, for example, above, let's say 10% is generally going to be disallowed. Cause lack of substantiation, they'll continue auditing people that are deducting. Let's say they'll give a little buffer, but the people over 30%, let's say they'll audit that because chances are there's going to be a nice change on it.
Uh-huh. Meaning people who are getting tremendous deductions is just going to be a red flag, and the real estate professional status overlaps with that because they are getting tremendous deductions. So they're just going to rate high on the score and the computer is going to flag them.
Yeah, it's a combination of the chances of audit and the amount of money that's brought in on those changes. Changing a real estate professional status is going to be a nice dollar amount of audit change.
Right. I mean, they run their business like anyone does, you know, focus your energies on the biggest money-making activities. And would you say that when they audit real estate professional status, they more often win or get money back?
A good percentage of it, that's for sure.
Right. And when they win big because, you know, these people who are saving millions of dollars in taxes over 5 years. Okay, so let's start from the beginning, right? So somebody, let's say you're working with the IRS. Somebody's gets audited. What's the process? So originally I thought real estate professional status gets audited, but you're saying that no, just like any person who gets audited, someone who's filing for the real estate professional status just has a higher chance of getting audited. So how does the process start?
Let me just back up. They could sometimes do specific projects. They could decide they're going after, you know, they do it in industries a lot. They'll pick some industry, like, you know, they'll pick on something, they even pick on weird industries. For example, I was once doing a project I was involved in this for truck drivers. So they do some of that on real estate professionals. They will do that as well.
Okay. But more often than not, it's just a regular audit on a tax return.
I mean, not necessarily. I mean, they do, when they are giving it to groups, it's usually specific issues, you know. There could be general, but there are a lot of specific, and they'll just do, you know, let's do all the real estate professionals. Let's do.
They'll just go ahead and attack. Qualifying for real estate professionals now puts you in the group of real estate professionals. And if they decide to go after that group, you're included.
Or if you're just, even in general, you're going to score higher, you know. You don't just do real estate losses. And obviously, real estate professionals aren't going to get in those audits.
Right. Got it. So what's the process? What could someone expect? Like a letter in the mail, a phone call? Like how's it start?
The way it starts back there is, okay, so it starts, like I mentioned, that DEF score is high. And obviously those returns that the score the highest are the biggest chance of audits. Once they have that pile of returns ready for audit or the higher scoring ones, it'll usually be a territory or a group will decide they're going to focus. Let's say they'll decide they want to do real estate professional, you know, status, or they'll decide they want to do real estate or even just a general group. They'll assign that to a group of generally revenue agents, or it could be even office audits sometimes, which are called the tax compliance officers or office examiners. They get those files, the income documentation, they're assigned that case to work. Now, the step of working the case when it hits the actual agent, before they actually even do anything, they do a general review of the return. First, to see if it even makes sense to audit, just because the computer scored it and it was given to an auditor, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be any tax benefit for the IRS for auditing. You know, there could be net operating losses or just small other types of losses or just no income on the return. You know, certain reasons that making a change will not be any advantage to the IRS. A lot of those, so you have a lot of those could get surveyed. And that's the end of the audit. Survey means they just, the auditor says it's not worth it. There's no tax benefit for the IRS. That's the end of that. But generally, what they're going to do when they decide to audit, they're going to screen it, make sure there's a audit potential on the case. If there's audit potential in the case, the auditor will review the specifics they want to go through. It's generally not going to be just the real estate professional status. They can go through the whole return. They'll go through even specific deductions, as well as matching all income and deductions, make sure everything's reported. And then they would schedule an appointment. And that's the beginning of the audit. Now, this process could take about from the first step, from the return is selected to even be looked at for exam, until the letter actually goes out, is generally a 4 to 8 month process. That's before even anyone starts. So the selection starts way before the actual audit.
Got it. Wow. Okay. So right now, as we speak, there are people that have letters on the way to their homes, letting them know.
Or the letter's not even sent out. There's a file sitting in some manager's office that could sit there for 3 months because they're having an extended Thanksgiving holiday at the IRS.
So what you're telling me is that these are standard IRS agents that don't necessarily know all the nitty gritty details and laws of the real estate professional status because there are a lot of them. How does someone go into an audit without necessarily knowing what counts and what doesn't count?
I mean, it's gonna be the general rules. I mean, that's like any deduction, any business expense or.
But qualifying for the real estate professional status, there's a lot of gray area. My understanding is you don't want it to go to tax courts. So you want to be able to convince the IRS agent of a good case. I know they get a guide, an audit guide. Is that what they follow or is there other training that they get?
Yeah, there's a evasive, long training for all IRS agents. It's usually a little overkill also, but right when they hire, they first do a general training. They basically look for the least attractive place to send you, and they send you there for five to 8 weeks for training. They basically took a map of the United States, looked straight for the middle, and just dropped and said, okay, let's send everyone there.
Got it. Okay, so they prep them beforehand, which makes sense. You know, just because I know the reps, the details and the rules and the laws and the cases that it depends on, it could get a little complex. So just wanted to know like how well-versed, you know, they're not just spending all their time on reps. It's just one part of the bigger picture.
I mean, there are some specialists on specific issues, but general auditors do the audits as well. And now don't be surprised if the CPAs could be more well-versed than the IRS agents. Don't ever think that because the IRS said so, that's the reality. The agents aren't necessarily the most educated or most competent when it does come to an audit.
I guess before I want to get into like how much the IRS agent's autonomy has over each case, can we get a bird's eye view of a whole process auditing a real estate professional status? And I guess just the real estate professional status aspect, what an IRS agent is looking for, how do they try to find holes? Like what's their agenda here? Just from beginning till end, think of maybe a case example that you've audited yourself and take us through it. So people have in mind what they should prepare for.
What's interesting, the IRS agenda is generally going to be they have preconceived notions that everyone's cheating them. So they're coming with that mindset usually. They usually pick on like, you know, 2-3 little things, which obviously could trip people up the most. Some of them are crazy and some of them are more realistic. Obviously, you know, a real estate professional, they have a few things to go after, which would generally disallow the whole status. So, you know, the first thing they're going to do is obviously they can go after the hours and they have a few interesting things they look at. One funny thing they always ask. Okay, so let's just back up to the actual how the audit works. We mentioned the letter that goes out. So what the letter is generally depends if it's an office audit. It could be online even. There's, you know, three types generally. It's in an IRS office, in the taxpayer's business, place of business, or the representative's business, or it could be online, you know, just through the mail type of audit. Either way, however they're doing it, there's generally going to be a initial letter, which is going to come with an IDR, which is a information document request. It's supposed to narrow down what you're looking at. Usually they're supposed to be, you know, 2-3 pages. I've been told to give some long ones that are as big as 40 pages.
And this, the client has to look through the auditee has to read through 40 pages?
They just do.
Or a power of attorney. If you didn't have a power of attorney yet, you're getting one now.
Yeah. I mean, that the IRS really couldn't care less. How efficient they're sending it out or making it easier on the taxpayer. You know, they could get in the mood, just send in everything. It goes both ways. Sometimes they give a very narrow initial document request and it just has, you know, 2-3 little items. You know, they'll write the, they'll start off on a regular individual, let's say. They'll say, we're auditing your charity deduction, your mortgage deduction, and then, you know, one little thing, they won't even say, you know, they'll say your depreciation deduction without even getting so technical into the real estate professional status. And once you come to the audit, right when they start with the questionnaire they have, they'll go through the whole qualifications of real estate professional in that part of the interview. And then they'll give a...
So they're like trying to surprise you.
Well, sometimes they're just trying to open up the audit as opposed to even getting too detailed before the audit starts. They're limited usually in time of preparation for audits. So they can't spend that in there. You know, let's say they get an hour, you know, on a regular individual, they sometimes give them only like an hour and a half to prepare before they actually, you know, just to send out the letter and set up the appointment. Once they start the audit, depending on the complexity, sometimes they let them spend 40, 50 hours on the case. So they'll dump all the time then. And it'll start off very innocent. They're looking at one thing. Really, they're trying to gut the whole rental and, you know, whole real estate profession and the losses.
Depreciation deduction audit does make sense because the real estate professional status allows you to take a bigger amount of depreciation.
Depreciation is one component, but that's going to be what's going to give you the real tax benefit.
Oh, wow. And they're really just looking to bring the person in. And then once they're in, and then they'll quiz them on the real estate professional status, seeing if they even know how to qualify for it.
Or they might just say, okay, we're looking at your passive activity law. You know, that could be very general or it could be specific. But either way, if there's a rental losses, and obviously you need to be a real estate professional to qualify for that, that's where the audit will probably go.
Uh-huh. Okay, so a person might not even be aware. They should definitely be getting a CPA involved at this point for sure to protect them against audit, and the CPA should know. But their game plan is to just nonchalantly mention it and then bring the person in and try to grill them and just win it that way. Basically show the person that they didn't qualify for it.
I mean, one of the big advantages of having a CPA go instead of the taxpayer is they ask you what you do day to day. Do you know about this? Do you know about that? The taxpayer is going to have a harder time realistically not knowing because he knows what he does.
Right. You can't say, I don't know, right? Where were you yesterday? I don't know.
Or it could even be sometimes dirty, you know, sometimes it's sneaky enough. It's just, oh, so what do you do? What are your hobbies? How much time do you spend on that a week?
No way. Are you serious? They probe random questions and try to get you to trip up?
Very little randomness. I mean, you know, there is a little opening.
Wow. So they'll ask you about your hobbies.
So how many hours a week do you spend on your hobbies, you know?
Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay, what are some other things they do like that? That's sly. That is sly.
And this could be general questions. Oh, how many, you know, and obviously when they're going after real estate professionals, so everything's going to be boiled down to the hours. It's going to be a lot of general questions about what do you do? You know, tell me about your day. What do you do? How many kids do you have? Who takes care of the kids? You know, they could trip them up like that.
So always send the CPA to go because you're going to get tripped up.
Potentially. It's not always. They're not always so dirty. Some are more than others. But the interview is trying to get the most information they could. They already have a preconceived thing. When they look at the return sometimes, this person is no way a real estate professional. So let's just get a few things out of the way and it's going to be impossible. And even the CPA, what are you going to do when you come back after you said you spent all week with your kids? You can't say you went on the weekends now to take care of the properties.
Exactly. Wow. Okay. Understood. Wow. That's important to know before you go in for that innocent interview on your depreciation deduction audit. Okay. So they're looking to trip you up to just get you to paint a picture that is contradictory to claiming real estate professional status. Are they looking for any specific thing, let's say a time log, right? I know that that's very important and most people don't keep
it. Right.
So what happens in regards to that? Like from your experience with the time log, do most people not have a time log?
So it obviously depends. Obviously the more professional are going to have a time log. The people that are ready for it will have it. People that were prepped before will usually prepare one, you know, at least after the fact, reconstruct the time log. There's no reason why it can't be reconstructed after. I mean, they try to push it on you that it wasn't done while it was happening. It's not accurate, but I don't think the reality is like that. If you come in with the log, if your log is good, you know, they'll generally accept it. Obviously, you have to, the log has to be good. Now, the log to be good, it has to be obviously they have to believe that this is a realistic picture of what happened. So obviously, the more specific you get, the more realistic it is. You know, someone just has, you know, 3 hours every single week. You're right, the 9 to 12 every single Monday, I was doing this. The Tuesday every week, so it's obviously going to be less believable. Then you have a more very specific, you know, March 17th from 9:30 to 2:15 I was doing here will be better than every week I spend 30 hours on the property.
Right, right. 2-3 hour asset management meeting. In each meeting should have different things happening.
It doesn't have to be that. Obviously, the meetings is going to be a minimal part probably of your real estate professionals. But yeah, obviously, the more specific you have, the more plausible and realistic it is.
So you're saying that reconstructing it afterwards really is fine, but the IRS will give you an issue and try to tell you that it's not fine. Would you therefore recommend someone do it live? Or would you say that wait until the end and do it backwards? As long as it's soundproof, you'll be fine.
Well, you have to have the information that you're going to go off. You have a daily, if you're going to be going through, your Easy Pass will show you whenever you went to the property, or you can start going through your credit card statements. You can figure out when you went places and, your bank statements, when the cash came in, you'll see when, when they paid rent and, or, when you paid your contractors or whatever expenses you had, you'd be able to reconstruct. But yeah, definitely a basic log to always keep would be the best.
Right. And what would be the best corroborating evidence, Easy Pass to make your case the strongest? I never thought about that, showing your Easy Pass without working. Credit card purchases I've heard of, invoices I've heard of. What are good corroborating evidences to go along with the time log that you've seen people do?
I mean, usually most logs are bad.
Most logs are not bad. Is it because they're reconstructing it? Or is it because it's just, even when they're doing it in real time, it's still just bad?
No, it's just a pain in the neck to keep a log,
Right. On the off chance that you're audited, it's hard to motivate yourself to keep it up.
It's a small chance of getting audited. Are you going to always be busy? Are you paranoid? Depends. But some people do have, I've had good logs,
Is that a great first impression?
For sure.
Right. Is there any other first impression besides the log? Is the log the first impression?
Well, substantiation wise, the log is going to be depends what the person does also. The way they scrutinize, the way they look at it, they have a few crazy things they ask first. Their first question they always asked for some reason in my days were, do you have a real estate license? That was like one of their go-to questions they always started. They always have this thing that, someone's more professional, it shows more about, what they're doing is a real estate professional, which is funny, just like they take appraisals at face value, no matter how out of whack it is. They'll take a cost seg from a professional more than they'll take it from you, even though technically, any cost seg, technically, even if it's not done by...
I'm a cost seg professional. What are you saying?
They would take your cost seg report a lot quicker than they take mine.
Right. Even though, you could technically, if you knew what you were doing, let's say you were an engineer and you did it yourself, not through a company, and it could basically be the same exact thing, they'll still say, you have to do it through... They care about the degree.
They care about official, they care about professional, and obviously third party also works better than, even if I would be an engineer and I'll have it all professional, everything licensed, but it's not third party, it's obviously less.
Understood. So what are some other questions? What are a list of questions that they go through?
Their first impression is going to be from the actual tax return.
Okay.
Looking at occupation on the tax return could make a big impression on them. Just, stuff like that. Does the husband and wife both have W-2s? They look at W-2s, and they're, unless you, show them otherwise, they're going to automatically assume you're working 40 hours a week. And they're going to start you off at 2,080 hours a week, as if you're doing the 52 weeks a year, 40 hours. I don't know if any of their employees are working 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year. But they'll start with that. If you both have W-2s, they're going to tell you that, okay, so you work full-time. How in the world do you have the hours?
Right. And you're going to say, I don't work full-time. You'll have to prove it. Is W-2 specifically, or is 1099 or any type of income? Is a W-2 more of a red flag? Same job, but just gets paid as an independent contractor.
W-2 they think of as an employee, as opposed to... You could be self-employed and do something for 5 hours a week, or you could be doing the 60 hours a week. So the 1099 doesn't show that you have a full-time job. Obviously, let's just say a 1099 for $250,000 for something totally unrelated to real estate.
Right. It'll also be a red flag.
They'll probably want to make the case.
And if, let's say, just the husband is a W-2, is that also bad? Husband being W-2, wife being, let's say the real estate professional?
No, that would be fine.
That would be fine.
Yeah, they don't need to both be, right? Yeah. the only one has.
Right, right. I mean, because that is something that's common where the wife will become the real estate professional so they could file jointly and get the tax write-offs. Now, that doesn't necessarily wave a red flag because it is plausible, right?
Correct.
Right. So it doesn't wave a red flag, even though a lot of people would like to get you to believe that it does. But it doesn't mean that you're not going to be audited. Husband is a doctor. Wife is a real estate professional.
Yeah, that would be fine.
That would be fine, right? But when they come to you and they audit you and they see the mother is not really made up of real estate material, let's just say, you know, more of a stay-at-home mom in such a situation who's just really taking advantage, that they'll be able to see and then the cards will be against you.
Yeah, don't write the occupation homemaker.
A cook, a recipe mom.
I mean, they will scrutinize in that, you know, the general stereotype scenario. That was your whole incentive to do it, and you're probably playing games, but it's not as bad as, you know, both of them having full-time jobs or two W-2s will definitely make it worse.
Right, right, right. Okay. So that's where they start. Tax return, occupation, husband, W-2. Next, they ask you, do you have a real estate license?
What do you do? Walk me through a regular day. What do you do? And that's when you're going to have to say, I'm spending time in real estate, you know?
So it's more of open-ended questions, not yes or no. It's not multiple choice, more open-ended questions. They'll make you feel uncomfortable. They'll make you feel like you have to keep talking. And then they're hoping that you go ahead and say one thing that contradicts your whole case.
That's a general rule in all audits. The general rule in all audits is open-ended and let them talk and talk.
No specific list of questions. Do you have a real estate license? And then like, what do you do on a regular day? Is there another question?
They do have a script for every issue. They keep on updating it. But yeah, it's going to be who's the real estate professional first, obviously. Is it the husband or the wife? What type of real estate are you doing? You know, what are you doing? What are the properties? Yeah, they'll definitely, obviously they'll get into that question, but they're going to start off very general.
Right. It's going to be like a podcast interview, no different. You know, just at the end of the podcast, you might have to give in millions of dollars back to the IRS. That's the only difference.
As a former IRS agent, you know, I always assume that the person interviewing me is trying to trip me up, so you never know. Never trust. They do have some dirty tactics. So.
Yeah. Everyone's favorite agency. Okay, so they give you a list through, and this is before you hand anything in. This is just preliminary, you know, conversation, and then you leave, and then you have to send in all of your proof. Do you bring proof in on the interview? Like, how's that look?
Yeah, that's usually, yeah, it's generally going to be, in this case, it'll be the log, which will probably be the most important. And then, you know, obviously documentation of all the expenses, assuming it's their own and not, you know, from other investments. It'll be a general interview with documentation. That's usually how.
Okay, so interviews with you. So in the interview, you hand in everything. They look it over in the spot where they just interview separately, where they're looking at your stuff live while they're interviewing you.
It's usually throughout the audit. The audit can be, you know, a lot of times it will come with analog and, you know, it'll be a follow-up, you know, for the actual documentation.
Okay. So now, besides just tripping themselves up in generally and just proving them to be absolute liars, let's say somebody is doing it correctly. What are certain mistakes you've seen people trip up on trying to do it correctly, but I guess not knowing all the laws? From your experience, what have you seen?
Most common is not to be eligible.
They didn't even get to first base.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most common. Most people are not going to be eligible, you know.
Right, right. But it's not like based on false assumptions of, let's say, being a mortgage broker and thinking that that's good, or thinking travel time counts, just straight up disqualified.
General, it's going to be, you know, people have real estate losses. They're going to take the real estate losses on the tax return. That's going to be the most general.
So they're usually quick audits for the most part.
Obviously, you know, if you come with the log and you come with the, you have the 750 hours and it's, you know, it's more than your W-2, you have material participation, they're still going to dig deeper. They're not just going to take it right away. But yeah, of course, there's going to be plenty of audits that get down to technical parts of it.
So right, right, right. But for the most part, now I really understand why, you know, just send the regular IRS audits, because most of them are easy home runs. The person is not prepared at all, like at all.
Either not eligible or not prepared to play the game, you know. It's a long game. It's not a...
Yeah, no, understood. Because I want to get into what hours count, what hours don't count, how they deal with gray areas, because everything is about convincing, at least at this part of the game, the IRS agent that you're legit, right?
Correct.
So you don't want the IRS agent to fight. You don't want to fight with him to say, let's go to tax court, right? You want to convince him in a way that he agrees, right? Because these IRS agents, are they also out to get you? Or if they see that you're legit, they're fine with like just giving you the check?
They have managers. I've had both type of managers. I've had some managers that, with the assumption that if someone's audited, there's something wrong. If the computer picked them up, then there must be a change, you know.
Uh-huh.
You must have everything perfect. And even after, you know, everything substantiated, they'd calm down. You know, like I start off with, let's say, four or five things I looked at, and everything was substantiated. And I said, this is a note change. Now let's call it a day. And they said, how about this? How about that? So it's generally, if they're audited, they're not looking to make a note change.
They're trying to get you to lose. So how do you make a convincing case without ticking off the IRS agent?
At the end of the day, there are a lot of audits that are no changes. A very small percentage, but there are audits that are no changes. As long as you have the documentation.
You're good, right. As long as you're doing it legitimate.
You have to have documentation more than being legitimate. The documentation is the key.
Right, and documentation includes a time log and proof of receipts. Bring us through the documentation. It's a time log. You mentioned Easy Pass, credit cards, bills, anything else that could help substantiate?
The log is going to be the biggest thing, especially in real estate professional. That's for sure the biggest.
Even if there's no corroborating evidence?
Corroborate the actual log?
Yeah, do you have to corroborate it?
To some extent, depends what, but you're saying you're collecting rent and, you know, they'll look for your deposits and they see the money never went in or something like that. You know, so that type they will do. Obviously, the big hours are going to scrutinize. You had 6 hours on this day. What were you doing? If you were shopping and buying stuff, or if you were doing construction or you're managing, what did you do? You know, and obviously, if it's something that could have any type of substantiation, they're going to want to see it.
Right.
But it's not going to be, for every all 750 hours, show me documentation.
Right. You don't have to now pull back all of your emails and show that you sent those emails. Like the fact that you wrote, spent 2 hours emailing, whatever it is. So they'll go ahead and decide, are those emails counted hours? But they're not going to ask you to show proof of the emails.
They might. They're going to see, depends what, obviously. They're going to probably do sampling. I mean, it's not realistic to come with, how much substantiation could you bring to show? You technically could.
Right. You have to fit into the doorway. You can't bring all those papers. Okay. So it's interesting that the time log in of itself could win you the case if it looks legitimate.
And has the most relevant items on it. The more crazy it is.
So what are some examples of hours that count that you see that don't count? Like bring us through, because I know a lot of it is debatable. Travel time, certain hours do count, certain hours don't count. I know the IRS audit guide says travel time does not count, but
courts have allowed it sometimes, right?
Courts have allowed it. So now, to the fact that the courts have allowed it, win in an argument against an IRS agent? Could. Could.
Obviously, that's not the number one thing you want to have to give you the hours.
So what are the qualifying activities that you see that work black and white? Give us a list of a few of them.
The best scenario, obviously, is going to be if that's your full-time. Your full-time job is in real estate. You own real estate. You're full-time in it. So one of the big questions they're going to ask always is they're going to try to find that you weren't the one doing it. You hired a management company. So if you hired a management company, what were you doing? That'll be like their classic comeback, whatever you say.
So what's the response to that? That I had too much, so I did still do the 750 hours, even though I had a property management company.
Well, obviously it depends on the size, right? Sizes of the properties. You know, if someone has the two family homes and they're saying they had 750 hours, it's going to be a problem. But if you have a large scale, obviously, as long as it makes sense, that's fine.
And most of these cases are, let's say the cases that weren't so clear and they ended up winning. Right? What were these cases of, let's say, someone just invested in real estate on the side just for the tax purposes? Have you ever had those cases where they actually won? Someone's a doctor, his wife is a real estate professional, and she did it the right way.
Yeah, definitely had. you know, let's say you have, you know, real estate agents, those you had, you know, especially if you show, because obviously this, you don't have a year of losses, but historically you've made a lot of money, you've been in this industry for years, your website shows that's what you do, and you show revenue coming in, it will be the best.
From the real estate?
Yeah.
What hours don't count off the bat? You said travel time.
Travel's great. Yeah. Travel's comfortable. Research is great. Yeah.
So what research hours would count versus not counting?
You want to know what they would definitely let and not let?
Yeah.
Minimal research on something you end up buying, obviously, has the best chances of going. Research hours on end without, you know, just general research. I'm looking where I'm going to buy my next property. I spend 6 hours a week on that. No more details, obviously. The more details, the more chances you have of that, you know. If you could say I was, you know, researching this property, let's say you're showing this property and you're showing you flew there or you went there, to be closer, to be more realistic, that you, you know, were constantly there, that would be the best. You know, someone says, I researched a property in, let's say, California, and you never even went there. Obviously, you lose the least chance that you'll get those hours. Let's say you show in Florida, and then you show you made 2 trips there. Or you show that you know, and then you'd want to pull some emails that you met people there. Or that you got, you made offers on the property. You know, even if you didn't end up buying it, it might, you know, help your case.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know that. I thought like you have to, and everyone tries to box it in, but
ideally you want to have you bought that property. I'm saying if you didn't, you know, at least you show you made an offer that was back and forth, or at least you went to see it. You know, if that's the only property and you didn't buy it, yeah, it's going to be problematic. If you own a few properties and you went to one property, you didn't buy it, that should be allowed.
Right. I wanted to also ask, just to make sure I get to this. Let's say there's certain activities that are questionable. So let's say, you know, I had a CPA tell me that plumbing is fine. Plumbing is construction, right? So somebody's a plumber, is on a 1099, so they could maybe possibly get the 750 hours via plumbing. Did you have any cases where a plumber was audited or an electrician was audited and won and that was considered construction?
No, I never did that. I've had crazier, but I never had, you know, the actual, you know, a semi, you know, a professional that's related to real estate, you know, indirectly, you know, or loosely related.
But that usually doesn't get audited, you're saying? Like,
no, that's definitely good. I mean, if that's the person, if that's what the person does, that would obviously be what they're going to come with when they get audited, if that's their only log and nothing more specific to the actual rental. Or
you have to be able to show that the rentals you materially participated in, you actually did do work.
But the truth is, you know, even if you have substantiation or logs or, you know, other supporting evidence, even if it's not going to be allowed, it's always good to have that in case, you know, let's say they're going to disallow it. You want to avoid getting an accuracy penalty. So the closer you show that you had some basis to it, even if technically, according to the law, it's not allowed, you're never going to win in tax court and you're never going to win an audit. At least you can negotiate down, or maybe not regular exam. Maybe you go to appeals and you could at least get off the penalty. So someone's going to have a bill for, you know, $150,000 from this audit. Any type of documentation you have, especially if you have a good log, you know, let's just say the plumber, they wouldn't allow, but you show that instead of having $150,000 bill with a $30,000 penalty, they would definitely get the penalty off.
Right, but you don't know that plumbing would count.
Yeah, no. Now, the courts have, you know, thrown on penalties, even for telling them you're in over your head for trying to claim real estate professional without consulting your CPA.
Right, but let's say a CPA tells you that plumbing is fine, because the reason why plumbing would be fine is because you're putting pipes in the ground.
In the real estate, right.
Yeah, so that just be an extension of construction. Like an all-purpose contractor probably would count his plumbing as part of his hours.
It might be. But I'm saying if it wouldn't,
you wouldn't get the penalty.
Right. I mean, the construction is very minimal guidance on it, right? Development, redevelopment has guidance, operation, management, right? A lot of them still are open-ended.
a lot of them. Development, I wanted to discuss an engineer, a designer, architecture. There's a lot of different jobs that go into developing properties that could or could not get it. So now what was explained to me by CPAs, and again, even CPAs are limited. Everyone is limited until something gets audited and put in tax court and wins or loses, right? And even then...
And it could go both ways in tax court.
Right, so you could have one...
And the tax courts have been wrong, you know, that not every detail is so so clear cut from them, you know, or so perfect from them either.
Yeah, so it's crazy. But somebody said that architecture is not integral, so nah. Like he said, it's not, it's more design. I don't know, like, why not architecture? I mean, an appraiser is good. So now what about a home inspector? Someone who is a home inspector, owns his own business, or is on a 1099, even though it has nothing to do with his real estate investing.
But it could be a real estate professional, technically.
I have a couple local small properties, do the material participation, invest in group syndications, and do the grouping, and he's good to go, right? Mm-hmm. So it's such a case, would the IRS push back at it? It'd be like, no, this looks too weird.
They'll probably push back. Always keep in mind, just because the auditor doesn't accept it, if you have a good case, it's always, obviously depending on the money and depends how much is at stake, but there's always a good chance on appeals you'll get something. Keep that in mind always, even if the audit goes bad and you don't want to go to tax court.
You could appeal it.
Yeah.
Tax court's for like the really loaded, rich companies. You know, who goes to tax court? There has to be enough savings there. Going to court probably costs like $100,000.
Well, even, you know, people will do it for the principle of the matter more than...
Right. That's, that's true. So you're saying cases that were just straight out won were just legitimate cases that they were in real estate and that's it. Cases that lost, they were just not prepared at all. They just thought that they would get away with it and they weren't able to even show a time lag or anything. Are there any interesting cases you were involved with that were gray, that went one way or the other?
I've had all different types. You're trying to say like a great type of...
Yeah, like something that could be put into practice, right? Because most people listening to this are trying to just make their case better. No one's going to listen to this and not have a time... I mean, people won't have a time lag, but not be prepared at all. You know, those are not the people listening to this. People listening to this are trying to do it correctly within their limitations. So, you know, I want to know what could take their gray case and make it a little darker.
It boils down to documentation. Because even if they're not going to go for it, you want to at least have your strongest case.
Okay, that's fair. So documentation is number one. That's going to substantiate your case and be as descriptive as you possibly can be. So to just, you know, end off with what are some, besides documentation, what are some things that somebody who is getting these hours now put themselves in the best situation to win a potential audit?
Well, obviously the hours.
The hours have to count, right? We took a bird's eye view of hours counting. If let's say you say an hour doesn't count, is there ever an argument between you and a CPA which hours count, which hours don't count?
As an auditor?
Yeah.
Well, of course.
So how does that go? So how does that, like, who decides that?
Well, ultimately the auditor doesn't decide what they're going to take. That's, you know, on any issue with IRS.
But why would the IRS ever agree to anything that's gray? Like, why would... I feel like why not just say it's audited and then audit them and then take everything back if they go to tax court. So you'll go to tax court. What are the chances people are going to take you to tax court?
There's always a good chance it's going to go to appeals.
Oh, the appeals sort of is the backstopper. The IRS is not interested in having to lose an appeal.
Right. You don't want to lose an appeal, although, you know, most of the time you will. But
the IRS.
The IRS, yeah. Because appeals is, you know, semi-independent, but... I used to have an office in the middle of the appeals floor, but officially it's independent. You have to make a case strong enough that when the taxpayer appeals will have information to, you know, hold on to your position.
Okay.
So yeah, you're always considering that it could go to appeal. So the IRS agent knows that it could go to appeal. So if someone has a case that they know they're going to lose, sometimes take that in consideration what they're taking in the gray area.
Uh-huh. Okay, so appeals is sort of the backstopper. Really, when you're preparing, so you want to convince the IRS agent, and you also want to be able to win the appeal.
Appeals is a very realistic, for most taxpayers, a place to, you know, win it if it doesn't work. You know, there's actually, you know, even before you go to appeals, there's always a manager to go to if you have issues with the auditor.
The way you made your manager sound like, I mean, at least some of them.
One that was like that and one that was a little more accepting, you know, or intimidated from CPAs.
Get a big, tall CPA who's scary.
I mean, also, you know, you want to be able to cite what you're going off. It's even cite them in 469, you know, what parts are unclear. There's no regs on this. This is gray. Or it's not even gray. It's all my, you're not going to want to say it's gray. You want to say it's all in my favor. There's no regs or anything saying otherwise. You want to draw the most similarities to the court cases in other parts of property, trade, or business. You know, let's say you're doing something on construction. You'd want to say this is similar to something that was allowed under development or something like that, even though you don't have a real court case. But at least you want to have something to cite to make your case.
Right. Meaning even if it's not a direct correlation, you want to be able to go ahead and use the court cases to say that this is similar enough to my case that I was able to rely on it.
And then generally, you know, to some extent, the agents are intimidated when you start bringing regs cases.
Tax court cases.
Either tax or the regulations, you know.
Well, we mentioned in the beginning, they don't necessarily know all the details and the ins and the outs.
And they usually don't know, right. They usually know just very basic. You know, they'll know the handbooks they get, the training they get. To know the nitty-gritty of Internal Revenue Code or specific cases or the regulate, they don't really know that detail. So, you know.
So if a CPA comes with an email or with a report basically saying, substantiating everything and referencing laws or court cases, that is something that would get an agent to maybe just concede.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. It's your best bet. You know, we could only try our best. It's an investment. It's a chance that anyone is taking. Even if they're doing it correctly, you could still always possibly lose the audit and have to return everything you made. But that's the investment that you're making with the real estate professional status. All right. Anything that you think we missed that maybe you want to speak out?
It is a person. You're not sitting there fighting against the tax law. You're not sitting there with a real deep type of intellectual conversation. Sometimes it's just the way it goes. The more realistic, the best the reality sounds, or the best picture you could paint, could win it, even if it's a little gray.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much. If anyone wants to reach out to you, what's the best way?
Go to my website, yd@jacobwoodscpa.com, or yd@ydjcpa.com, or you can call me at 732-426-1040. Those last four numbers should be easy to remember.
Oh, yeah, especially if you file 1040s. So I'll put the contact information in the show notes. Thank you so much, and looking forward to keeping in touch.
Okay, thank you.